So Mehdi is from the University of Santa Clara, and he'll talk about relational dynamics, interacting clocks and systems, and quantum time dilation. So please go ahead, Mehdi.
Thank you, Misha. And thanks to the organizers for organizing such a nice conference. As you can see, I'm also missing being on campus, so I've included one photo. So it's nice to be interacting with people. And this conference has provided me with this opportunity already. And you might notice that I'm a bit stressed. It's because I lost my presentation. I've been trying to retrieve it during the break. And I think I can, I have a version which is not finalized, but on my iPad, but I think I can try to do a relatively okay job with that. Okay, so this is a work that I've done mainly in collaboration with one of the organizers, Alex Smith. And with that, I'll just start by giving you the outline of the talk. And sorry about the, again, these are just snapshots from the website because I didn't have time to include them. So first I'll start by explaining motivations for relational quantum dynamics. And in particular, I know that we have different frameworks for relational quantum dynamics. For example, Carlo Rovelli has his own framework, which I think is present. And also, but the one I'd be focusing on is the Pigeon-Wooters formalism, which is the one that we've heard a lot about in Philip's talk, I think, in Esteban's talk, to an extent. And I think there was another talk that I can't remember right now, but we've heard a lot about it in Lorenzo's talk. Yes, we've heard about that as well. And basically, I'll try to give a very quick summary of motivations that we have for using Pigeon-Wooters formalism. And then I'll explain these two work that you see here. One of them is about including interaction in the formalism, interaction between the clock and the system. And the other one is about trying to see whether we can use it to observe quantum time, what we call quantum time dilation. I'm gonna have to explain this later, but this is the general format of the talk, outline of the talk. And I'll start by relational quantum dynamics. And just to give you a framework is, you wanna look at the dynamics of the system when we have promoted our clocks to a quantum clock. And we wanna look at the dynamics of the system with respect to that clock. So the motivations that we have here are from the beginning, they're basically, even in the Pigeon-Wooters paper from 82, and they are twofold, or maybe they have three, but these two for sure. One of them is that for asymptotically flat universe, the long-range gravitational field provides a super selection rule for total energy. So the super selection rule for total energy is one motivation which causes the relative phase basically to be unobservable. In this case, it would be time, which is encoded in the relative phase. And another very closely related motivation to this type of argument is this one here, which is communication in the absence of synchronized clocks. In when we have super selection rules, that basically means that we don't have coherence between subspaces with different energies. So you can think about it as this G-twirling operation that we've seen in the talks many times so far. But for what it does is that it projects the state of the universe basically into different energy subspaces with different probabilities. But the relation between this and the communication in the absence of synchronized clocks is what I want to explain, which is a work that we did in 2015. I was not originally planning to include this in the talk, but I think it's good if I just put it in the context because it connects with the talks that we've had already. And that is, we were looking at this scenario. So let's say that we have Alice and Bob. Alice wants to send some classical information to Bob. The classical information I'm showing by lambda. So she's going to encode the classical information in the relational degrees of freedom of two systems. One of them is a quantum token of her reference frame. So this is a well-known description. I should mention that in the quantum reference frame community. And she will encode this parameter lambda inside the relative degrees of freedom. And then she sends this state, which is now encoded in the relative degrees of freedom. And Bob's task would be to decode this information to retrieve lambda as best as possible. So now, if Bob's reference frame is not aligned with Alice's reference frame, and if Bob knows the relation between the two reference frames, what he can do, he just does a passive transformation, and then, of course, he can decode the information, right? But the scenario you're interested in is the one where basically Alice and Bob doesn't know the relation between his reference frame and Alice's. So then he has to average over all the possible orientations. And then what that does is that introduces some noise here. That is that G-twirling noise. And then this problem reduces to what is Bob's, how able is Bob to decode this lambda encode that is encoded inside this, given that now there is some noise in the system. The thing we did was basically this. We used this operational measure, which is known as quantum Fisher information. It tells you how well you can distinguish between rho lambda and, let's say, rho lambda plus some epsilon. And then the measure we looked at is, what is the quantum information in the absence of the noise? And the difference between that and the quantum Fisher information of the G-twirled state. And then what we had, we wanted to find the necessary and sufficient condition in order for the quantum information to not have been reduced. So that's why we called it quantum information loss, and we wanted to make this zero. We wanted to find that necessary and sufficient conditions. And the necessary sufficient condition was for all these guys to be zero. So now I have to explain what these guys are. This G that you see here is the generator that's responsible for the encoding of lambda. So you have, let's say that U lambda that you see here, this one, is e to the I minus IG lambda. So that's encoding the parameter. And I'm sorry, that's not G, that's K. That's the one that is this one, is responsible for the encoding of lambda. So it's encoding the lambda in the relational degrees of freedom. And then this G is the generator that's relating the two descriptions of Alice's reference frame and Bob's reference frame. So for example, if Bob's reference frame is rotated with respect to Alice's, it would be a rotation, that G. So this relates Alice's reference frame to Bob's. And then what we can do is to write down the spectral decomposition for this generated. And these projections here, what we find is that the covariance of the projections and the operator responsible for the encoding has to be zero for all the projections. And I want to mention that it was known in the past that if the generator G and K, they both commute, then this works perfectly. But what I want to say is that this adds to that, because this is not quite the same as saying that G has to commute with K. This is a stronger condition, whereas the one that we find is a weaker condition, and it is a necessary and sufficient condition for this process to be giving us this loss of information zero. So I just wanted to quickly mention this because I thought this connects to the scenarios that we've looked at. And I want to just speculate that this could be used in this scenario where we have, let's say, two clocks. Here we have a clock for Alice's, and here we have a clock for Bob. Their clocks are not synchronized. They don't know the relation between their clocks, and they have to average over the time using the Hamiltonian. So here your G would be the Hamiltonian. And what would be K? The K that we have here would be the Hamiltonian of the system. So if, and then the question is, can we connect this to the Pagan-Wooters formalism? And that's the thing that I've been, I would like to think about. I haven't thought about that, but I thought this was very, that was one of my motivations when I started working on Pagan-Wooters formalism. So with this, I just want to move on to the second motivation, because I don't want to spend more time on that, which is the one that we are using in the two papers that I mentioned in the beginning. And that is when the Wheeler-DeWitt equation we've heard a lot about, and where we get the so-called frozen time, there is no evolution. And this can be written as a similar kind of projection into zero subspace. And these are our physical states here. And this is very different from the one that we had there. One is projecting into energy zero. The other one is projecting into different energies with different probabilities. So that's what I wanted to mention. And I wanted to be clear on the fact that from now on, what we're doing is doing this one. Or we are basically going to use this most of the times. We are going to write down a constraint, a Hamiltonian constraint in all the cases, and then we are going to use the states that satisfy the constraint as physical states, basically. So first, I want to explain what kind of, just give you an idea of the kind of clocks that we are thinking of. We can have two different types of clocks. I have two different, I mean, we can have many different types of clocks, but I have two here. One of them is a particle that's moving in position space, let's say, and the Hamiltonian is a momentum that's generating translations in the position space. And if you notice here, this is basically, we call it the ideal clock in this sense, because tau prime, these are orthogonal. So in that sense is that we call this ideal. And I want to be clear on this, because later I'm going to have something that I'm going to call optimal, and that's going to be very different from this one. So why do we call it ideal? Because you can basically distinguish different times perfectly if they're orthogonal. Spin half clocks, you can have similar things where this time your Hamiltonian is this spin Z kind of Hamiltonian. Your clock states are going to look like this. But as you notice here, your clock states are not going to be orthogonal. I'm going to explain these a little bit more, but I just wanted to give a quick two quick examples so that things are maybe a little bit more clear from the beginning, but let's see. I was planning to go into details of this, but I think I'm going to go very quickly. This is a work done by Giovannetti, Lloyd, and McConan. Lorenzo is here, and we heard his talk earlier, which was great, and it lets me do this very fast. So I call it, this is the Hamiltonian constraint as we had before. As for in the beginning, if you have no interaction between the clock and the system, then what you could do is that you just could introduce an identity here, and you'll see that you have a highly entangled state, well, an entangled state between the system and the clock. And then you go and condition the state of the universe, if you like, or the system and clock on the state of the clock. And then you ask, what is the state of the system? How does it look like? Then you go and take the derivative with respect to time, impose the Hamiltonian constraint, and you'll manage to recover the Schrödinger equation, as Lorenzo also explained. So I'll just quickly go through this one. But then what we did was to include an interaction inside this this whole process. We wanted to know whether we can come up with a Schrödinger-like kind of equation when we have interaction between the system and the clock. So the physical states are still the same thing. The process here, we're going to introduce identity there. We're going to look at the state of the system conditioned on the clock reading time t. We take the derivative with respect to time. We get this extra term here, which is the interesting, which is the addition to the Schrödinger equation, which causes our evolution to be modified. So, but what this is, it's an integral operator, as you can see. What is more important is that it's an adjoint, self-adjoint operator. What else do I want to mention about this? Yeah, so then I'm going to just the self-adjoint operator, I'm going to show it by HK. So that this is this modified Schrödinger equation that we find, which is something that we felt like was missing from the whole picture. But then the question was, how can we solve this? We seek basically series solution for this. And this lambda that you see here is inside the interaction Hamiltonian. So we do a series solution. So if you like, we can write down H interaction as lambda H bar interaction. And that's the lambda that we are considering. So that's the strength of interaction, basically. We look for the solution, and we find, we manage to solve it. It's a Dyson-like type of solution. And what is interesting is that it's unitary. So that was very promising. We solved the equation. We found the unitary evolution, and one of the motivations for this was the original work by Don Page, in which he's computing the entropy, and the entropy is non-monotonically changing. That's what motivated us to look at finding a Schrödinger equation with a unitary evolution, and that's what we managed to do here. We considered a few examples in our paper, and the one that I thought maybe makes more sense to include for in this conference is the situation when we have gravitationally interacting clocks and systems. So we have a clock. Yep.
Sorry, just to say you have 10 minutes plus 10 minutes for questions.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So, we have a clock and a system that are interacting, and this is just a Newtonian gravitational rule. And what we do is that we just quantize these mass operators that we heard about from Magdalena in her talk as well. And I think there are other papers, I think by Esteban and Chaslov group, where they consider such Hamiltonians as well. I'm sorry that I don't have the reference here. I had it in my finalized form of the, but I lost it. So this is the best I could do in the time that we had. I'm going to try to explain what it is. This KTT prime, let me just try to bring it here. The definition was just up there. Is this interaction Hamiltonian, and those are the two clock states that we had there. Once you compute this one, which is inside your integral operator, you get a derivative of a delta function, and this is the clock, systems Hamiltonian, and then the modification looks like this, which is inversely proportional, of course, to the distance between the two masses. However, there's that C4 there that makes it, I guess, unobservable at this point. But it's very small. But I thought, even though it's a very small effect, I should consider it given the audience. That's one example. In the paper, we have another example where we find a time-dependent Hamiltonian. So you may find that one also interesting, but I don't want to spend more time given that I have don't have enough time. So what I want to focus on is a more careful definition of the quantum clock that we are using. We define our clock as a quadrupole, and we have it has some Hilbert space, has some Hamiltonian. There's a state that encodes the quantum time, if you like, or the elapsed time, as we call it, and it encodes it in a unitary manner using the clock Hamiltonian. And also, this is the operator that we end up measuring on the clock to measure the time. And I'm going to explain what this operator should be to get an optimal clock. That's what I want to explain here. The things that we want our operator to satisfy, there are two conditions. We want it to, on average, to estimate the elapsed time. So this is what is known as the estimator being unbiased in quantum estimation theory. The variance of the clock operator, we want it to be independent of elapsed time, meaning that we don't want the variance of the measured time to depend on tau, basically. We want our clock to perform the best for all the given times. That's what we want to happen. And then we know from the covariance estimation theory, the good thing is that we can use those tools from there. There's a covariant POVMs that were mentioned also in Philip's talk, I think near the end. And the covariance condition is basically saying this. This is the covariance condition. It's basically translating the encoded parameter in this covariance manner. But I want to explain what this means in this picture just by saying, why is this crucial in our scenarios, which is timekeeping? So we have a fiducial state that's encoding the parameter tau. And what we do is that we use this covariant, this POVMs, and this mu here, we don't get it to be a projector, but we get it to be a multiple of a rank one operator. So, and we do this because it's known that if we do anything other than this, in this paper, you can find the proof that the resolution is gonna reduce. So this is definitely gonna, this is a good choice. What we do then is that we have our fiducial state, our initial state of the clock, the time tau, the elapsed time tau gets encoded inside the state. And then we want to measure our POVM here to be able to see what is the time, how much time has passed. And then we look at the condition of probabilities. These are just very standard notations that are used in covariant quantum estimation theory, basically. So what this says, this condition of probability, says that given time tau that's encoded in this state, if you measure your POVM, What is the probability of getting Xi given that tau was encoded? And then what we can do using these operators. So this is here, you're fixing the POVN if it's fixed, right? And then we just compute something. You can compute something that's known as a classical quantum, classical Fisher information. This is the formula. What it tells you is that how well you can decode the parameter, basically, given that particular measurement. And that gives you a lower bound on your uncertainty. And what we want to do is to what should happen is that these two equalities should saturate. And for these two to saturate, and also we don't want this to depend on tau, so that this is independent of tau, the lower bound. So for these two to happen, this happens due to using the covariant POVMs. If you impose the covariance relation, this happens. And for saturating this equality, we basically have to have our psi clock, the fiducial state that we have there, the one before encoding, we want it to be, this has to be Gaussian. So given if we use a covariance POVM, and if our fiducial state is a Gaussian, then we manage to saturate this proper time clock energy uncertainty relation, which is, as I saw that there was some discussion in the chat, it's only in the clock's space. It's not the one that we're being discussed, which is going to be different. So it's in the clock space. So we use, so this, now I want to start explaining this other paper. Can you, how much time do I have left?
You have 2 minutes plus 10 minutes for questions.
Okay, thank you. So, right. Okay, so another thing that we wanted to answer using this formalism was that we wanted to know if we use internal degrees of freedom of a clock to keep track of dynamics of a system center of mass, how can we observe time dilation or not? What we did was to write down the Hamiltonian constraint. So let's just focus on this. We are looking at the positive energy sector. And once you quantize it, you get this term, which is just a conjugate momentum for temporal degree of freedom. And then we have the clock Hamiltonian, and we have the center of mass Hamiltonian. And then we end up getting an interaction Hamiltonian, which is an interaction. We call it interaction Hamiltonian because it's an interaction between the center of mass and the clock Hamiltonian. And but then what we do is that we, motivated by the Page and Wouters formulas, and we look at probabilities we have two clocks that are moving into two wave packets. They're Gaussian. We look at if they're just Gaussian wave packets, what we manage to do is to see that we can show that the classical time dilation is observed, but it's observed on average. So what this is telling us is that this, given that the clock B reads tau B, on average, the clock A is reading this time, which is exactly what we expect from the classical theory. The only difference is that this is seen on average, simply because we are using a quantum clock. So the one thing, the first message is that the quantum time dilation should be thought of on average. One, and the other one is that now that we are using a quantum clock, what we can do is to see if there is something really quantum. By that, what do we mean? That it cannot be observed using classical clocks. So what we do is that we prepare such a state for the clock. So it's a superposition of two wave packets. And we compare this to the case when we have statistical mixtures of these two wave packets. And we see that in this case, when we have the superposition of the two wave packets, when we compute this, the same quantity, which is the average time observed by clock A, given that the clock B has read tau B, there are two contributions there. We call one of them a classical contribution, this one. And why do we call that classical contribution? Because that's the one that you would get if you have classical mixtures of two wave packets. And then there is an extra one that you would not be able to see using a classical clock, simply because this makes no sense in the case of a classical clock. So then we look a little bit into this. All right, I'm going to explain a little bit because I only have a little bit of time. Okay, so what you see in this picture is that gamma, the quantum contribution. So we are plotting the quantum contribution, and we are doing that for different sums of momentum, for different values. And what we see is that, first of all, in all cases, as you can see, this is a sanity check, that here, when the two momenta are the same, when the difference between the momenta are zero, we should get no quantum contribution. Also, when the distance between the two wave packets is between the peaks of the two wave packets is too big, we're expecting to get zero, and we do get zero. And these are the optimal points. So these two are optimal points, and for different values, as you can see. Another thing I want to point out, that the quantum contribution could be positive or negative. So it could increase the quantum, the time dilation effect, or it could decrease it. So that's another interesting point about this. I think I'm going to just skip this one in the interest of just mentioning that the same kind of effect has been observed in a different kind of, different but at the same time similar, in the sense that, let's see, we have what they have done in this paper is they've considered atomic center of, they've considered the case where you prepare an atom in such a state, and then you use internal degrees of freedom, which here would be, you're basically looking at the transition rate, this transition rate, to keep track of time. And they want to look at the difference that you would see between the two transition rates when you're preparing, when you have a superposition of wave packets, and when you have a classical mixture of two wave packets, basically a convex combination of two wave packets. And interestingly, they end up getting exactly the same expression as the quantum contribution that we had there. So this kind of suggests that this quantum time dilation that we see is perhaps not independent on the type of system that you're looking at. I should say that, which I found very interesting and very promising, and that's why we're looking at other scenarios to see. This is a work in preparation. I don't have time to talk about that, but I'd be more than happy to talk about it in the discussion. And then we do a back of envelope calculation using some state of the art experiments there. We see that time dilation is observed using quantum clocks moving with several meters per second, and that atomic superpositions have been separated by several meters per second have been created. We use these two, and we come up with an estimate for our quantum contribution. And we reach the conclusion that if the coherence time of the superposition is longer than the atom's lifetime, then this seems very feasible with these state-of-the-art numbers that I just mentioned. Right, I should also mention that these are two different experiments. So in practice, if one wants to do this, this is just a back of envelope calculation. In practice, if you want to do that, I'm not sure how these two experiments are going to be compatible. With this, I want to thank you for your attention. And I want to leave some time for the questions. Hopefully we have some time.
Great, mate. Thanks for the great talk. It was very good, even though you didn't have you lost your slides. We have 4 minutes for questions. So if people have some questions, please do ask. So first person is Lorenzo Marcone. So please ask.
Yeah, sorry. You were showing this time dilation. Can you also use similar tricks to do like a Lorentz transform from one reference frame to the other? It's not clear to me.
So are you referring to
time dilation in a sense? It comes from that, right? If you
Yeah, I see what you mean. To do a full kind of Lorentz transform, this, for example, considering any spin and, I don't know, entanglement between spin and momentum, the kind of things I think you also mentioned in your...
Oh, yeah, for example, yeah.
Right, yeah. That's something that that's a very good question. That's something I have been thinking about, and I wonder if you do that kind of Wigner transformations.
Right.
Yeah, that's I haven't done that. That's a very good question, but... Unfortunately, I don't know what's going to happen if you do that.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Also we have a question from Robert Mann. He could ask his question, please.
Hi, Mehdi. Thanks. An interesting talk. I'm just trying to, this thing we're looking at right now about the quantum time dilation, I think it's quite interesting, but effectively is that there's a background time being presupposed. Is that right or not? It looks like in some sense, there's a laboratory background reference frame or reference time
that's
effectively being assumed. Is that correct or have I missed something?
No, in fact, I just rushed, I think, I rushed through the end bit. I did not mention here that this is the state that we have already imposed the time, the Hamiltonian constraint on. So when we compute our conditional probabilities, it does not depend on any background time.
Okay, the pictures suggest otherwise, but you're saying it really doesn't depend on that.
Yeah, that's misleading. I see why where the question is coming from, and this side is basically the one that, just to be more clear, is the one that satisfied the Hamiltonian constraint. So in that sense, there's no background time. I should have somehow, I don't know how to show that in the picture, but I'll think of some way for the next one.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for the question.
Just to add to that, those wave packets are, like Mehdi is exactly right, that the probability distribution doesn't depend on any background time, but those wave packets, that superposition is defined with respect to a specific lab frame, I guess, if you want. Like it's a, you know, these are the average momenta with respect to the same frame, but the end result is that we're looking at something that doesn't depend on the background time, because these are really conditional probabilities between the proper times of these two clocks. So.